Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the negotiations continue in Washington over the much-talked-about fiscal cliff.
And it's interesting to note, Mark, that words like compromise and common ground are cropping up more frequently in the discussion over what to do about those fiscal changes looming on January 1, 2013.
Well, it rings in the new year and also might ring out the Bush-era tax cuts, which expire on January 1st, and spending for a number of social programs, including Medicaid, we'll see an instant reduction unless some kind of negotiation is found.
The president wants to see taxes increase only on the wealthiest Americans, while the Republican leadership is still calling for those social programs to be put on the table for discussion, including the health care law. Hard to see those as social programs.
That's true. Deja vu all over again, because there really hasn't been much progress from either side on their respective ideas about how to solve the problem. But it is interesting to note that more politicians in the GOP are backing off of their no tax increase pledge. Mr. Norquist may not be happy about that.
So we'll see how the negotiation progresses in Washington, with fewer politicians perhaps strong-armed into just say no.
Whatever the outcome of the fiscal cliff discussion, it's going to have a big impact on the areas including healthcare, education, and infrastructure rebuilding, and probably even Social Security.
But it's also unlikely that the Affordable Care Act will be dismantled or, in my opinion, tampered with to any significant degree to make way for that tax compromise. But we'll see if I'm wrong.
That would be good news for today's guest, Dr. Joe Selby, who is the executive director of the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, also known as PCORI.
PCORI is one of the not-so-well-known provisions within the Affordable Care Act, and Dr. Selby is one of the nation's top healthcare researchers and is using his expertise, and particularly his focus on the patient experience, to advance PCORI's mission of promoting research that gives us the data on healthcare practices that yield the best outcome for patients.
And we'll hear from FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson, who looks at claims on Capitol Hill on the healthcare law. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And don't forget, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Joe Selby in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Mary Ann O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Mary Ann O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The healthcare law continues to be a topic of contention, legally and politically. Discussions are underway this week on how Congress plans to deal with the upcoming fiscal cliff, when a number of social programs see their financial support ending and a number of Bush-era tax cuts are due to expire. Republican House Minority Leader John Boehner says there can be no discussion about compromise on revenues without the healthcare law being part of that discussion. And the Supreme Court has cleared the way for another legal challenge to the law. Liberty University, a Christian college in Lynchburg, Virginia, claims the law forces their organization to subsidize abortions and contraception. The High Court has decided to allow their challenge to be heard in oral arguments in the 4th District Court of Appeals, paving the way for the challenge to move closer to a hearing before the High Court. There are numerous other religious-based challenges to the healthcare law waiting in the wings. Meanwhile, the American Academy of Pediatrics is wading into this controversial territory. They issued a statement this week urging pediatricians to pre-prescribe emergency contraception, known as Plan B, ahead of time to all teenage girls under 18. Plan B is available without a prescription for those 18 and older. This would eliminate the need to seek out a doctor for teens worried about the possibility of a pregnancy. When you think of foods that seem synonymous with a healthy diet, grapefruit comes to mind, but folks taking any number of medications should take note. A study out of Canada shows the properties in grapefruit can alter or inhibit the efficacy of as many as 85 different kinds of drugs, including statins commonly prescribed for cholesterol and high blood pressure. The side effects occur when furanocoumarin, a chemical in grapefruits, binds with enzymes and prevents them from properly breaking down the drugs. ABC News has posted a full list of the drugs at risk on their news website. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, executive director of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, known as PCORI, an independent nonprofit health research organization authorized by the Affordable Care Act. PCORI was created to provide patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. Dr. Selby is a family physician, a clinical epidemiologist, and recently served as the director of the Division of Research research at Kaiser Permanente, where he oversaw 500 research clinicians and 250 ongoing studies. Dr. Selby is an author of more than 200 peer-reviewed articles and continues to focus his study efforts on diabetes and quality improvement. Dr. Selby, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you very much, Mark and Margaret. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, we saw that President Obama was reelected, which really bodes well for the continued advancement laid out in the Affordable Care Act, which established PCORI to shift the focus of healthcare research to really take into account the patient-centered experience and to evaluate patient outcomes so that improved quality and patient outcomes govern health policy and practices. So, could you tell our listeners a little more about PCORI and what's new and innovative about your approach and what kind of impact you expect to have on patient outcomes in healthcare?
Yes, PCORI is brand new, and I want to emphasize that PCORI is a research funding organization. So we will be providing funding to researchers, to clinicians, to patients, particularly when they join together to apply for funding. And we are interested in research questions that provide useful information to patients and their caregivers and their clinicians as they face critical healthcare decisions. It's the existence of PCORI and its placement in the Affordable Care Act. Recognize that despite the fact that we actually spend $150 or $60 billion a year on clinical research, in this country alone, it's still the case that patients often get to a decision point and don't have practical information that really compares two or more options that form a decision that patients have to make. So we focus on trying to fill that void, provide that clinical information, and we pay particular attention to what works for whom. So we recognize that the same treatment doesn't work exactly as well for every patient, and sometimes one has to tailor these treatments to who the patient is.
So, Dr. Selby, the PCORI model set out to establish a format, kind of a new format, for researching outcomes to involve patients and their providers, and to do it using comparative clinical analysis. And in an article in Health Affairs, you outlined two very different research approaches: investigator-generated research, such as clinical drug trials by pharmaceutical companies or testing of surgical devices, but also a patient stakeholder-led approach. Tell us about the difference between these two research protocols and how does that play out in a research protocol? What does it mean to have a patient stakeholder approach?
Well, we're trying to get the patient's voice and the clinician's voice into the research process. And we think that if we do that, it's more likely that when the research is done, it'll answer the right questions. Oftentimes, the research is done, it's very elegant research, it just doesn't quite answer the question that clinicians were asking or patients were asking. So we have two approaches to getting those right questions. They can both be just about any kind of clinical questions, and we really think both pathways are important. We send out broad announcements explaining the kinds of research comparisons that we're interested in. We say, send us the most compelling questions, and when you do, join with patients, join with the relevant clinicians, and tell us why this question is important to patients. So we're very open and interested in what researchers and patients and other stakeholders come up with on their own and submit to us. But sometimes patients and clinicians and others aren't really prepared to just sit down and write a research proposal. And so we engage patients and their patient organizations, clinicians and their organizations in a kind of ongoing brainstorming session that looks for the right questions. And then we invite them to join us in prioritizing them and helping us decide which questions, if answered, would be the most likely to provide information that's lacking now, the most likely to change practice, the most likely to improve outcomes.
Dr. Selby, you bring a nice combination of qualities to your position. You're a brilliant research leader and you're a tireless patient advocate. You've identified five key target areas in particular. Can you tell us a little more about what they are and how will they govern where PCORI grants go in the future?
The statute itself told us that before we could start funding research, we had to get together with the stakeholder community and identify the priorities that would guide our research. Now, they could have been very narrow priorities. We could have focused in just on five diseases if you wanted. We didn't. We named five broad priority areas, and I'll tell them to you in just a minute, but I'll just say that we think they fit together nicely. Mm-hmm. So here's the first one. It's called Assessment of Options for Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment. That really gets at questions at the patient level about which treatment or which preventive measure works best for me. That's kind of the classic comparative effectiveness research paradigm. And that's only one of our five priorities. The second one is called improving healthcare systems. And so that just recognizes what I know you two know, that the system where patients get their care has a lot to do with whether they hear the options, whether they get the options, whether they get follow-up, whether their care is coordinated best for whom. So improving healthcare systems is the second. The third is called communication and dissemination research, and that just recognizes the fact that once you get the evidence collected and established, you've got to find ways to get it out so that people are aware of the evidence. The fourth is addressing disparities, and that just is based on the widely recognized fact now that treatments don't work the same for everybody. So we start from the fact that there are disparities, and we say, we will fund research that addresses ways to eliminate those disparities. And the fifth is a priority about building the infrastructure to do more of this research. We really think we need to change the culture in this country so that out in the clinics, out in the hospitals, out in the healthcare systems, we are asking and answering these questions all the time, that patients and their clinicians come to recognize that when you don't know the answer, when you're making decisions and advising patients on what to do and you realize you don't really know the answer, the best thing to do is ask the question and get the answer. And for that, you need an infrastructure. You need to put clinical data together into large databases. You need to find ways to analyze those data more effectively. So you need better methods. And we need to train both researchers and clinicians and patients to participate in this research. So that's the fifth one, our infrastructure priority.
That third piece, the community participatory approach, can be very challenging. I wonder if you could share with our audience what you've seen around the country in terms of best practices of how people are bringing communities of patients together. What are people using as strategies to get at that patient stakeholder involvement that you've seen as being successful?
Well, first let me say, Margaret, that I completely agree with you. I like to say sometimes that what we do here at PCORI is community-based participatory research applied to clinical questions. We are not, by and large, studying issues in the community as much as issues in clinical decision making, but we use all the principles that led to the development of this community-based participatory research movement. So, we have a very active website with lots of ways for patients to get engaged with us. We talk about building a patient and patient advocacy community across the country, and that's growing rapidly. We have online ways for patients to submit questions that we then process and put into the prioritization scheme. Very exciting. Patients have a hand in formulating the questions and in collecting and looking at the data. And that's just one of many, many examples. There are many online communities already formed, often organized around a particular disease, often around rare diseases. Mm-hmm. And those patients have come together in substantial part because they want to contribute to research. So we're looking for ways to partner with them. We're looking for ways to link these kinds of online communities with the clinical data that exist for them in electronic health records. Mm-hmm. So we think that's a part of the solution. We think that surveys and particularly social media type of surveys are a good way to keep our finger on the pulse. You know, we look for a lively, vibrant, two-way program of communication. We also are forming advisory panels. So these will be smaller numbers of people, but selected from large pools of applicants to be representative to help guide PCORI and advise PCORI. And so they'll watch with us over time and keep us hopefully on the cutting edge of patient engagement. There's a lot to be learned just about how to do it right.
We're speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, Executive Director of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, an independent nonprofit health research organization authorized by the Affordable Care Act. PCORI was created to provide patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. You know, I want to sort of pull the thread a little on one of the five priorities that you talked about before, and that was really on communication and dissemination. But I know we're engaged with the Dartmouth Institute on the clinical microsystems change process, and I know one of the biggest problems and challenges that we have, there are a lot of good practices and important things for people to do, but that change process is very difficult out in the clinical setting. So past sharing the information, What other tools in the tool belt are you giving practices to help them with this transformation that they're all going to need to go through over the next many years?
Well, it's a very good question, Mark, and you are right that systems and the clinicians that work in them don't feel like they have a lot of time on their hands to sit around and discuss change. This is happening on the fly as they're very busy seeing patients and trying to make decisions. I think one principle that we're pretty convinced is important is that there has to be something in this for everybody. So clinicians and patients have to feel like they're getting something out of this process of change. It can't in any way be a top-down approach. So, that takes us back to our principle of involving these key players from the beginning. Often these ideas are not one-size-fits-all ideas. So the same intervention doesn't necessarily work for 100% of patients. And if you're not careful, your interventions will improve care for some patients, but they could actually worsen disparities or differences between patients. So we think that is done better with patients at the table. And, the third thing to say is that we will be funding implementation research. So we're very interested in how you take evidence and put it into practice. Mm-hmm. But a lot to be learned, as you suggest.
Well, Dr. Selby, I think the dichotomies certainly that we've seen historically is that the research lives within academia, the practice lives within the community, and the gap and the chasm between the two can be very broad because it takes, of course, skill and resources and training to do the research. Maybe you could speak to us a little bit about how are you seeing people bridge that gap? How are the universities and the traditional centers of research connecting with the community-based partners to do this critical work of designing the research studies that address the five key areas that PCORI is focusing on?
Well, I think it is going to be a change. Having been one of those researchers, I think it does represent a change. In our very first announcements issued last May, we laid out these instructions that you must have relevant patients and other stakeholders involved in the team. And we got on the order of 1,300 letters of intent, people saying they were submitting applications. But when the application deadline came, we had just 488, and that's a remarkable fall off. Right. And when we polled people, the applicants who had said they were going to send us proposals, they told us that the main reason they didn't was because it was taking more time than they thought to establish these connections. Mm-hmm. So that's a signal to us that you're right, it's difficult, but on the other hand, the availability of research funding and the requirements we put in are having an effect. And over time, we're going to waste a tremendous opportunity if we don't study these interactions and learn from them what works the best. But we are very clearly seeing these partnerships. I mean, they were there before we came on the scene, and our funding is strengthening those partnerships. We really hope also that we see some new players at the table in terms of who's leading these. So we'll be delighted to see applications come in from community clinics, neighborhood health centers, patient organizations. We'll be delighted to see them in the lead of these applications and bringing researchers along to make sure we get the methods right.
Dr. Selby, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world, what do you see in terms of innovation in healthcare that our listeners at Conversation should be keeping an eye on?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I think this appreciation, as we've been talking about already, of the critical care of systems and the potential for systems. Most people still get their care in settings that really you'd have to admit are not part of organized systems. So there's just a huge potential for organizing care more thoughtfully, for aligning the incentives of the various players so that people are talking to each other and they're on the same page. They're trying to accomplish the same thing, which is improved outcomes. And so I think systems have just an amazing amount going for them, and I think the Affordable Care Act recognizes that in many, many ways. And the second is this relatively new idea that whether we're talking about pills or surgeries or systematic approaches to care or health education, they're not going to work the same for everybody. And we have to pay a lot more attention than we have to the fact that patients are different. So whether we're talking again about medication, surgeries, or system interventions, more attention to who the patients are and tailoring those interventions I think is going to lead to what some call personalized medicine, but it's also going to just lead to smarter medicine and more efficient medicine. And goodness knows we need more efficient medicine.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Joe Selby, Executive Director of PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which is an independent, nonprofit health research organization committed to providing patients and providers the most informed prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options in healthcare by conducting rigorous research on national patient outcomes. You can find out more about his work by visiting www.pcori.org. Dr. Selby, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we looked into claims about the Affordable Care Act from a conservative group called Americans for Tax Reform. The group had posted an image of what it said the IRS would require from individual taxpayers because of the law, but it makes false claims. The group said that taxpayers would have to disclose personal health information to the IRS to prove they have coverage, and that failing to comply with the law would result in, quote, interest against your property. But the law says the IRS can't file liens or levies, such as seizing property, against those who don't have insurance. And IRS officials have said the agency won't collect any personal health information, nor would it need to. We don't know the exact forms or procedures the IRS will use to determine whether taxpayers have coverage or should pay a tax for not having it. But so far, we know that health insurance companies will send taxpayers a proof of coverage form that individuals will then attach to their tax returns, as the former IRS commissioner, Douglas Shulman, explained in 2010. The IRS will simply ask if individuals have coverage and the name of the company, he said, and match that information with the reports from the health insurance companies themselves. Shulman said the IRS's role had been, quote, way overstated. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Low literacy rates have been linked to poorer health outcomes around the globe, so Nicholas Negroponte decided he should do something about that. The chairman emeritus of the MIT Media Lab has been on a mission since 2005, the year he launched One Laptop Per Child, whose mission is exactly that. Negroponte figured his organization could meaningfully change the lives of about 100 million children living in the world without access to education. He felt that such a sturdy, child-friendly laptop relying on solar power could change that statistic. What they found in this stage of the project was pretty astounding. Not only were children learning to read and acquiring knowledge, but they were also teaching their illiterate parents how to read.
What if we go to these parts of the world where there are no schools? There aren't any. There are no literate adults. And, of course, the children are illiterate. 100 million. What can we learn from the kids teaching their parents is that we can try an experiment where the kids teach themselves. And that's the new story.
Negroponte was so inspired by the children teaching the adults that he tried an experiment in an Ethiopian village that had no teachers, no schools, no literacy. That brought boxes of computers to the village, left them there with no one to instruct the children in any way.
Within 5 days, they were using 47 apps per child per day. Within 2 weeks, they were singing ABC songs in the village. And within 5 months, they had hacked Android.
Negroponte, speaking at a recent M-Tech conference at MIT, says this could enable a whole new way of teaching around the globe that effectively has the power to eliminate illiteracy. And one hopes improve the economic and health figures of these children as well. The One Laptop Per Child organization now has deployed 3 million computers in 40 countries and 25 languages, distributing a simple, durable laptop into the lives of children who would have otherwise been left illiterate, changing their world for the better and offering a promise of a brighter future. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.